market values had fallen. If you paid 10 times cash flow for a company and valuations in its industry then recede to an historical norm of 7.5 times, a common scenario in 2009 and 2010, you would have to lift the company's cash flow by a third just to get back to break even on your investment. In a protracted and weak economic recovery like the one many people were anticipating, that feat would tax the skills of the ablest corporate executives. Many buyouts done at the market peak may turn out to be dead money, investments that may not lose money but tie up capital for years because they can't be sold, dragging down returns. TXU, the record-breaking buyout of a utility by KKR and TPG, looked to be such a case. Regulators set TXU's electricity rates based chiefly on the price of natural gas, but the company relied heavily on coal to generate power. It had minted money when gas prices were high relative to coal, but gas prices unexpectedly dropped after the buyout because of new gas discoveries and falling demand, squeezing the utility's profit margins severely. At the same time, electricity usage tumbled as the economy slowed. By 2009, the company was barely making enough money to cover its expenses, including interest payments, and the outstanding loans and bonds likely exceeded the company's value, extinguishing the value of the equity, at least on paper. Little of the debt would come due before 2014, but the company started to renegotiate and extend its loans and bonds. It appears that it will take years of hard work for the owners just to preserve their investment, let alone make a profit. It could easily go down in the books like RJR Nabisco, the largest deal of its era and the biggest dud. KKR ultimately booked more than 20% loss on RJR when it unloaded the last piece of the investment 18 years after the buyout closed. In the rosiest scenario for the buyout business, values and cash flows generally will recover over several years. But the longer that takes, the lower the investment returns will be. Selling at a 50% profit after 2 years yields a robust 25% return. After 5 years, it's a mere 10%. Returns on most of the mega buyouts that epitomize the boom times are therefore likely to be dismal. Many industry insiders predicted that collectively, private equity funds raised in the mid-2000s would not break even, performing even worse than funds raised at the end of the 1990s that were invested during the last market high. The push by some firms like Apollo, KKR, and Carlyle to diversify away from LBOs into other asset classes by launching business development companies and publicly traded debt funds also proved calamitous. A $900 million mortgage debt fund that Carlyle raised on the Amsterdam Exchange shortly after KKR launched its $5 billion equity fund, was leveraged with more than $22 billion of debt and capsized in 2008 when its lenders issued margin calls and seized all its assets. It was a complete wipeout. KKR Financial, a leveraged mortgage and corporate debt vehicle in the United States, had to be propped up by KKR and barely survived. Its shares sank from more than $29 in late 2007 to less than 50 cents in early 2009. Apollo Investment Corporation, the business development company that Apollo created in 2004, beating Blackstone and others to the punch, took huge write-downs. Meanwhile, the shares of KKR Private Equity Investors, the landmark Amsterdam Fund, lost more than 90% of their value by late 2008. In addition to the chokehold the faltering economy put on highly leveraged companies, the buyout industry faced two other crises. Its investors were tapped out, and there was a looming mountain of debt to be refinanced beginning in 2011 and 2012. For a decade, pension funds, endowments, and other institutions had stoked the LBO business by reinvesting their profits back into new funds. When the markets turned, there were no buyers for private equity-backed companies and no demand for IPOs, so there was no way to cash out of investments. The steady profits that had streamed back to investors for years dried up, depriving them of money to recycle back into private equity. Worse still for the investors, the distributions petered out while some of the biggest buyouts, including Hilton, Harrah's, Clear Channel, and TXU, were still pending in late 2007, and they faced the wrenching prospect of having to ante up amounts they couldn't really afford. By December 2007, distributions basically came to a screeching halt, but the capital calls kept coming, which burned a hole in limited partners' pockets, says one investor. Pension funds had to scramble to muster cash to pay retirees, and university endowments told their institutions they had nothing to give. Investors were forced to liquidate stocks and bonds into a falling market, widening the sell-off. California's giant teachers pension plan, CalSTRS, was so cash-strapped that it pleaded with private equity firms not to call on existing commitments. The colossal sell-off of stocks and bonds that ensued only compounded private equity's fundraising problems. As investors dumped stocks, bonds, and other liquid assets at fire sale prices, the value of their overall portfolios sank relative to their private equity holdings, which were valued based on their long-term potential, and thus didn't slump as much. As a result, private equity rose as a percentage of the investors' total assets, which threw the investors' asset allocations out of whack. Private equity's investors had to curtail new commitments to buyout funds in order to rebalance their accounts. Private equity also faced another enormous problem. More than $800 billion of leveraged bank loans and junk bonds were due for refinancing from 2012 to 2014. Even if the economy turned up by then, many companies might still be worth less than the bloated sums paid for them, meaning that there might not be enough collateral to refinance their debt. If not, the equity might be wiped out, and the company's creditors might seize control. There was a danger, too, even if the companies were worth more than their debts by then, that the debt markets would not have recovered enough to absorb all the scheduled refinancings, in which case there might not be enough credit to go around. Any way you looked at it, private equity faced a forbidding landscape. Blackstone was not spared when the financial roof caved in. With no investment profits on the horizon and fewer new investments in the pipeline, the firm laid off 150 employees at the end of 2008, and its business remained in limbo the next year. As a public company, Blackstone's stock price served as a daily referendum on the firm and its prospects. In February 2009, with the future in doubt, the stock dipped to $3.55, down more than 90% from its peak on the triumphant opening day. Peterson felt so badly about the money his assistant and his driver lost on their Blackstone stock that he reimbursed them for their losses. That month, the firm announced that its earnings had dropped so much that it would not pay a dividend for the final quarter of 2008, the dividend that had been a key selling point for the IPO. Schwartzman, who had designed his own compensation to consist almost entirely of investment profits so that his interests would be aligned with those of Blackstone's investors, collected only his base pay of $350,000 in 2008 and 2009, less than one-thousandth of the $398 million he made in 2006. Its stock price notwithstanding, Blackstone fared better than many competitors. 3 years after the credit crisis began, only one of its holdings had gone bankrupt. Freedom Communications, the parent of the Orange County Register newspaper, in which it had invested $280 million for a minority stake in 2004. But Blackstone also wrote off its $343 million investment in Financial Guarantee Insurance Company, the bond insurer that had expanded from covering state and local government bonds to riskier mortgage-backed products. FGIC was still in business, but like other bond insurers, it faced potentially ruinous claims on securitized investment products it insured. A slew of other investments looked in 2009 like they might end with losses, too. The crafts retailer Michael's Stores, a socks maker, Gold Toe Moretz, and the German plastic films producer Klockner Pentaplast, all bought in late 2006 or 2007. The $749 million Blackstone invested in 2006 to buy a 4.5% stake of Deutsche Telekom, Germany's main phone company, was also deep underwater. The biggest worry in Blackstone's private equity portfolio was Freescale Semiconductor. Blackstone had rounded up more than $4 billion of the $7.1 billion of equity needed for the deal, including $1.2 billion from its own fund, plus a large chunk from its fund's investors. This was the deal Blackstone partner Chip Shore had nearly sewn up when KKR dropped in a last-minute bid, forcing Blackstone to jack up its offer by $800 million. Blackstone and the three other private equity firms that invested alongside it, Carlyle, Primera, and TPG, knew the semiconductor industry was cyclical and anticipated that business from Motorola, Freescale's biggest customer, would taper off, and they put up 38% of the price in equity to keep the company relatively lightly leveraged. Things quickly veered off course. Motorola's cell phones were eclipsed by competitors' models, and its market share, which peaked at 22% in 2006, the year Blackstone signed up the deal, fell to 14% in 2007, and just 8% in 2008. Simultaneously, Freescale's second biggest business, selling chips to car makers, went into freefall. In every fund, you get one or two deals where literally everything goes wrong. Freescale was that deal in our Fund 5, says Schwartzman. The last time something like that happened was HFS, the Ramada and Howard Johnson franchisor, where we listed all the things that could go wrong, and every one of them happened in the first 6 months. An invasion in the Middle East, oil prices spiking to then unprecedented levels, the world being thrown into a global recession, and, as a result of that, the franchise agreement was thrown into default. Motorola's drastic loss of business alone would have been problematic, he says, and no one foresaw the downside on the auto parts side. The idea that the number of cars manufactured in the United States was going to plunge from 17 million at the top to 8.5 million units annually was unprecedented in my experience. In our lifetimes, I can't remember when volumes went into single digits. A depressed year was 12 million. In early 2008, barely a year after the Freescale buyout closed, Michael Mayer, the CEO Shore had cultivated for years, was pushed out by the private equity owners. In 2009, the phone chip business was reeling so badly that Freescale unwound its supply contracts with Motorola and said it would sell or close the unit. Freescale shuttered plants in Scotland, France, and Japan. Chip sales, which had run $6.4 billion in 2006, The year Blackstone pursued and won the company, nosedived 45% to just $3.5 billion in 2009. In 2009, some of Freescale's bonds traded around 10 cents on the dollar because investors feared a default. The company went into the crisis with large cash reserves and no debt due for several years, and it restructured and bought in debt to ensure it remained solvent. By 2010, chip sales were rising again, and it looked like the company might be out of the woods. But unlike the HFS investment, which after its brush with disaster ultimately proved to be a roaring success, Blackstone will struggle just to recoup what it invested in Freescale. The game on a deal of this sort is basically to keep it alive, Schwartzman says. With all the things that went wrong, this is like a military operation where your platoon is cut off behind enemy lines. You've got to stay alive. You've got to fight your way out. You've got to get reinforcements. If you do that right and you're a wise commander, a lot of your people will live to fight again some other day. Real estate was also a big concern. John Gray had called the market perfectly when he sold off 2/3 of Equity Office Properties Towers in early 2007. But the prospects for commercial real estate had turned so bleak by 2009, that a pall hung over Blackstone's investment. EOP had proved to be a disaster for the moguls who had bought buildings from Blackstone. Gray's deal had left a trail of carnage across the real estate industry. Harry Macklowe, who paid an unfathomable $6.6 billion for EOP's Manhattan office towers, lost them all a year later, when his interim loans came due. By then, the mortgage market was frozen, and the properties were worth far less than he had paid, so he was forced to turn them all over to his lenders, along with another trophy property, the General Motors building on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, which he had pledged as additional collateral. The fallout from EOP was felt all across the nation. Brian McGuire, the founder of McGuire Properties, which bought many of EOP's Southern California properties, was booted out as CEO after the purchase left the company overextended. Thomas Properties, which acquired EOP's Austin, Texas portfolio with Lehman Brothers, found itself in a bind when Lehman went bankrupt and couldn't supply some of the financing it had promised. Morgan Stanley's real estate fund handed its lenders the keys to 5 ex-EOP buildings in San Francisco, 2 years after the bank bought them, and Tishman Speyer Properties defaulted on loans for 3 towers in Chicago it acquired from Blackstone. Even the crafty Sam Zell, who had personally pocketed $1 billion selling his EOP shares, came away a loser. He redeployed some of that money in a wildly over-leveraged $8.2 billion buyout of Tribune Corporation, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, which went bust in 2008. It was a particularly devastating collapse, for Zell financed the LBO in part with an employee stock ownership plan, and some employees lost both their jobs and their savings. Because Blackstone received such extravagant offers for the EOP buildings it sold, it ended up paying only half what the properties were worth in 2007, in effect earning a $3.5 billion gain on paper. But with office rents falling and few new leases being written, the rump of EOP was worth far less 2 years later. There was $3.5 billion of equity on the line, the most Blackstone had ever risked on a single deal. In mid-2010, Blackstone took the first steps to negotiate extensions on EOP's debt so it wouldn't all come due in 2012 to 2014, when so many other companies will be trying to refinance. An even bigger question mark was Hilton Hotels, in which Blackstone's buyout and real estate funds and co-investors had sunk $5.5 billion of equity. Gray and Michael Che, who led the deal for the buyout group, saw a chance to capitalize on an underdeveloped brand and turn around a poorly managed company. A year before the Blackstone takeover, Hilton had purchased its sister company, Hilton International, which owned the rights to the Hilton brand overseas. The namesake brand hadn't been fully exploited abroad, and the American company's lower-cost, limited-service brands, such as DoubleTree, Hilton Garden Inn, and Embassy Suites, hadn't been licensed at all overseas. As a result, there was room to expand the business. At the same time, costs were being trimmed. Under Blackstone, the company franchised 50,000 new rooms a year in 2008 and 2009 in places like Turkey, southern Italy, and Asia, which lifted cash flow sharply in 2008 and promised to elevate it permanently. Blackstone also moved Hilton's headquarters from pricey Beverly Hills to unglamorous but cheaper suburban Virginia. But with travel falling off sharply in the recession, Hilton's business suffered badly. The company was in no danger of failing because Gray had insisted on a financing package that wouldn't trip up the company if there were a downturn. The firm knew from bitter experience how cyclical the hotel business could be. Not only had it narrowly staved off disaster in 1990 at HFS, when travel fell off during the Persian Gulf War and Schwartzman and Henry Silverman had to fly to Hong Kong to beg a break from the owner of the Ramada brand, it also had another scare in 2001 with the Savoy hotel chain, when the chain's creditors threatened to foreclose after bookings dried up in the wake of the September 11th attacks. This time there were no loan covenants, and Hilton had no debt due until late 2013, giving Blackstone 6 years to make something out of the business. Even so, the recession pounded Hilton, and in April 2010, after long negotiations with Hilton's lenders, Hilton underwent a debt restructuring. Blackstone agreed to invest an additional $800 million to prop up the chain, and the banks, which had never been able to syndicate most of the debt from the deal and were stuck holding it, agreed to take a haircut. The accord reduced the $20 billion of debt on Hilton's books to $16 billion. On top of the slump in travel, Hilton became embroiled in a dispute with one of its biggest competitors, Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide, Incorporated, which charged that two executives Hilton had hired from Starwood had stolen 100,000 Starwood documents and, with the knowledge of Hilton's CEO, used the information to plan a new chain to compete against Starwood. Soon, federal prosecutors launched an investigation as well. Hilton and the executives denied wrongdoing. An economic recovery would give Hilton a lift, but the deal certainly was not going as Blackstone had expected. Chapter 25. Value Builders or Quick Buck Artists? The financial crisis called into question everything about private equity, its future, its role in the economy, and its capacity to create value. The business had expanded over three decades in benign economic conditions, with generally rising markets and low interest rates, and that growth plainly owed a lot to the rising economic tide. The debt crisis of the late 1980s and bursting of the equity bubble in the early 2000s were small corrections compared with the global meltdown in 2008 and 2009, which put to the test the industry's claims that it is a catalyst for value creation. Despite rebranding itself as private equity, and notwithstanding its attempt to cast itself as a business of corporate craftsmen who create value by reshaping businesses, the buyout industry has never outrun the reputation that stuck to it in the 80s. The image of buyout artists was enshrined then in books like Barbarians at the Gate and Oliver Stone's movie Wall Street. In the public's mind, they were ruthless job cutters who loot their companies of cash and assets for the sake of short-term profits. 15 years after the Wall Street Journal won a Pulitzer Prize for its story about the fallout for employees from KKR's restructuring of Safeway, Business Week reprised the theme that private equity hurts the businesses it buys. In Buy It, Strip It, Then Flip It, a 2006 feature about the buyout of Hertz Corporation the year before, the magazine told readers to be wary of buying stock in Hertz's upcoming IPO because the fast buck artists hadn't been shy about backing up the Brinks truck to the rental car company, milking it for a $1 billion dividend. But is it a game of stripping, slashing, and flipping that hurts companies and the economy? Even if buyouts don't inherently harm companies, do private equity firms actually add value to businesses while they control them? Or are they instead just like other successful equity investors, such as mutual funds or hedge funds, which buy and sell at a profit without altering the businesses in which they invest? The answer to the first question is clearly no. Private equity as an industry does not harm the economy. The answer to the second and third is that they do sometimes add fundamental economic value, but a good portion of their profits derive from buying and selling at the right moments and leveraging up to accentuate their gains. But that's no sin. Despite the persistence of the boogeyman strip-it-and-flip-it image, it isn't borne out by the facts. Take Business Week's portrayal of the Hertz case. Hertz was a classic case of an orphan subsidiary crying out for new management when Clayton, Dubilier, Carlyle, and Merrill Lynch bought it from Ford Motor Company in December 2005. Ford viewed Hertz as a captive customer for its slow-selling cars and had paid it little attention. The new owners rethought the way Hertz financed its fleets, saving money by buying more cars outright than leasing them, and lowered its borrowing costs by issuing bonds backed by the vehicles instead of unsecured corporate bonds. Under Ford, in the quest for market share, Hertz had opened non-airport rental offices in the United States that lost money. Many were shut. Overhead costs in Europe, which were several times higher than in the United States, were slashed. Employees' suggestions for more efficient cleaning and car return procedures were adopted, and consumers were encouraged to book online or use self-service kiosks, which cut costs. Executive compensation, which had been tied to market share, a factor in opening the money-losing offices, was changed to focus on cash flow and other metrics. The changes quickly paid off. Hertz's revenue rose 16% in the 2 years after the buyout, and cash flow was up 24% or 35%, depending on which measure you use. The $1 billion dividend that the magazine lambasted the owners for taking was actually no strain on the company, which threw off $3.1 billion in cash that year, and its cash flows were rising. Despite the payment of two dividends, in the 2 years after the buyout, the company paid down more than $500 million of its debt. The bulk of the improvement took place with only minimal job cuts, barely 2% in the first year, despite the office closures. When home construction slowed in 2007, severely hurting Hertz's large equipment rental businesses, there were bigger cuts. The company ended that year with 9% fewer employees than it had at the time of the buyout. But by then, the economy was in recession. Investors who heeded Business Week's warnings to shun Hertz's IPO lost out, for Hertz's shares nearly doubled in the year and a half after they were offered. When the economy and travel slowed further in 2008, Hertz's stock fared at least as well as its main competitors. Plainly, investors did not see Hertz as hobbled by its LBO. It pays to be skeptical, then, about the pot shots that are routinely aimed at the industry. Many are simply false. Hertz could be dismissed as an anomaly, but a growing mound of academic research refutes the charge that private equity damages companies for the sake of profiteering. In a study of 4,701 IPOs in the United States over a 23-year span to 2004, a French business professor commissioned by the European Parliament found that the stocks of private equity-backed companies did better than comparable companies, belying the notion that LBOs leave companies in tatters. It stands to reason. How could a form of investment that relies on selling companies for a profit survive if it systematically damaged the companies it owned? Why would sophisticated buyers like corporations acquire companies from private equity firms if they were known to strip them bare? The oft-repeated suggestion that buyout firms foist their companies on unsuspecting investors in IPOs likewise makes no sense. Most IPO investors are institutions, such as mutual and hedge funds, banks, and insurers, which would have caught on long ago if private equity-owned companies were weak and overpriced. Moreover, buyout firms almost always retain substantial stakes in their companies for years after they have gone public, as Blackstone did with Celanese and TRW, KKR did with Safeway, and Clayton Dubilier did with Hertz. So their profits hinge on sustaining the company's success over the long haul, not on dumping the stock at an inflated price and hightailing it. Academic studies also debunk most of the other standard knocks on private equity, that it kills jobs, strips vital assets, and takes a short-sighted view of research and development. To be sure, buyouts often are followed by job cuts, but companies cut jobs all the time, with or without a takeover, so the test of private equity's impact is how it stacks up against the corporate world at large. The most exhaustive survey of the impact of private equity ownership on employees, which looked at more than 4,500 investments from 1980 to 2005, found that private equity-backed companies tended to slash jobs at a slightly higher than average rate in the first 2 years after a buyout, but over time created more jobs than they eliminated. Contrary to what critics say, in the first 4 years following a buyout, companies owned by private equity firms add new positions at a faster clip than their public company peers, though the gap then narrows, according to the 2008 study led by Harvard Business School professor Josh Lerner and funded by the nonprofit World Economic Forum of Switzerland. The exception is in manufacturing, where the job growth is on a par with other companies. As for quick flips, there are relatively few of those. Investments of less than 2 years accounted for just 12% of private equity-backed companies, while 58% of the companies were held 5 years or more. The survey also found that, contrary to common wisdom, private equity-owned companies generally don't stint on crucial research and development spending, though they do focus research dollars on core product lines where the stakes are highest, while de-emphasizing more speculative peripheral research. There are risks, of course, to leverage, which elevates a company's fixed costs, potentially endangering the business in a slowdown. In every recession since 1990, scores of companies have given way under their LBO debt loads. Still, the overall casualty rate for private equity-owned companies has been remarkably light. The World Economic Forum study found that, on average, 1.2% of private equity-owned companies defaulted each year from 1970 to 2007, a 37-year span that included three recessions. That was higher than the overall rate for all U.S. companies, which was 0.6%, but still low, and it was well below the 1.6% for all companies that had bonds outstanding, which is arguably a more comparable pool than the set of all companies. Another study by the credit rating agency Moody's Investor Service in 2008 found that private equity-owned companies had defaulted at much lower rates than other similarly leveraged companies while the economy was expanding in the mid-2000s. Any way you figure it, only a small fraction of companies that have gone through LBOs have failed. Those that have were often forced to cut jobs, but few of the businesses ceased to exist. Most were simply taken over by other companies, by new investors, or by their creditors. The latest recession, which has seen defaults spike, could put those comparisons to the test, of course. There is little support, then, for the contention that private equity ownership generally harms businesses. But how do buyout firms make their money if not by slashing costs to lift profits? And do they contribute anything to the economy at large in the process, besides generating profits for their investors? Private equity executives, hoping to share some of the plaudits that venture capitalists garner for funding new technologies, often claim that their firms make their money by making businesses better, creating fundamental economic change that benefits society. David Rubenstein, the co-founder of Carlyle, has gone so far as to pitch yet another rebranding. Private equity should be called change equity, he has argued. So far, there don't seem to be many takers. The boast is that private equity firms do not just make well-chosen, well-timed investments and plump up the gains with some leverage. They have learned how to manage and transform businesses to create lasting improvements. There are doubters. Even many limited partners and private equity executives are cynical about the source of the profits. The bulk of the money that's been made in the private equity industry is from declining interest rates, which started in 1982, says the head of one established mid-sized buyout firm. The use of leverage and the declining interest rates, I believe, are responsible for 75% of the value created in the last 25 years. Academics who have analyzed the nature of the profits, however, have found that leverage contributes a surprisingly small part of investment profits overall. The European Parliament study of IPOs concluded that while roughly a third of the gains on successful buyouts trace directly to leverage, the rest derive from long-term increases in companies' values. A more detailed study of 32 highly successful European buyouts, they had an average internal rate of return of 48%, found that just 22% of the profits were due to leverage. Another 21% resulted from increases in valuation multiples, that is, the multiples of earnings that investors think companies are worth. The remainder, more than half, came from sales growth and profit margin increases. The study didn't attempt to break out what portion of the gains in sales, cash flows, and profit margins stemmed from the business cycle, that is, from buying at the bottom of the market and selling after a rebound. The truth is that private equity's profits arise from a mixture of all these factors: leverage and other types of financial engineering, good timing, new corporate strategies, mergers and divestitures, and operational fine-tuning, some of which create more fundamental economic wealth than others. Big private equity has grown not only because debt was plentiful for most of the last 25 years, but also because these firms have been adaptable, squeezing profits out by pushing up leverage in good times to pay for dividends, wading in to perform nuts and bolts overhauls of underperforming businesses at other points, and when the economy was down, trading the debt of troubled companies and gaining control of others through the bankruptcy process. Private equity firms are nothing if not opportunistic, and their techniques vary with business and market cycles. Playing market swings doesn't create new wealth in the same way that wringing out inefficiencies, funding research, or repositioning a company to make higher value products does, but it has produced high returns for pension funds, endowments, and other investors. If LBOs don't tend to hurt businesses, there's no more social harm to this form of ownership and capital structure than there is to a mutual fund that trades public stocks. Moreover, even bottom fishing in a recession provides capital to companies when it's hard to come by and provides liquidity to sellers when there are few buyers, a different form of economic and social contribution. It's an overstatement, though, to claim that private equity's profits today come primarily from building better companies. Tony James frequently boasts that two-thirds of Blackstone's gains come from increases in cash flow, implying that the businesses have improved fundamentally under Blackstone. But Blackstone can't take credit for all of that. Perhaps even more than its competitors, Blackstone has made its money investing at troughs in the market, so that a larger share of the financial improvement at its companies can be traced to the business cycle than to operating refinements. In an internal analysis of its investments through 2005, Blackstone calculated that more than 63% of its profits had come from cyclical plays like Eucar, American Axle, Celanese, and Nalco, though less than 23% of its capital had been invested in that kind of deal. By contrast, where Blackstone attempted profound transformations of the companies it bought, as it did with Collins and Aikman, Imperial Home Decor, Allied Waste, and the Callahan Cable Systems in Germany, its record was dismal. 14% of its capital had gone to such investments, and together they had lost 2% of all the capital the firm had deployed over 17 years. Even so, Blackstone and other big buyout shops have concluded that the only way they can outperform the stock market over the long haul is to systematically improve the companies they own. Bain Capital, which grew out of the Bain and Company Consulting Group, was one of the first to take that notion seriously and has the largest staff of experts and seasoned managers assigned to its investments. TPG long ago built a deep team of operational experts because it had a tradition of tackling messy turnaround situations that required a lot of know-how and attention. KKR, too, formed an internal team of managers in 2000 that now numbers 40, and Carlyle built up an inventory of executives on its payroll. Blackstone was a laggard in that regard and has been playing catch-up since 2004, when it hired James Quella, a former management consultant who had worked at DLJ Merchant Banking, Credit Suisse's private equity business, to set up what resembles a captive consulting firm. Quella's 12-member team of corporate managers vets companies before Blackstone invests, and its members are often assigned to work with portfolio companies when Blackstone takes over. That shift toward a more hands-on approach to reshaping portfolio companies can be seen in Celanese and three case studies of other successful Blackstone investments in the mid-2000s. These examples show how much the emphasis has evolved over time from a crude paring of expenses at portfolio companies to laboriously improving their operations and expanding and reorienting them. Gerresheimer AG. Call it a makeover. That was the gist of Blackstone's strategy for the German packaging company Gerresheimer, which over the course of a decade shed its skin as a glass bottle maker and emerged as a producer of sophisticated, high-margin pharmaceutical containers. The result was one of Blackstone's most profitable deals. In less than 4 years, it made more than 7 times its money. Some of the credit goes to 2 prior private equity owners, InvestCorp and Chase Manhattan Bank, which rescued the company in 2000 from an ungainly ownership structure. When they bought Gerresheimer, it was 51% owned by the German industrial and utility company Viag AG, which was preoccupied with its pending merger with another utility company. The balance of Gerresheimer's stock was publicly traded, so management had to answer to public shareholders as well as its parent. Gerresheimer's CEO, Axel Herberg, a one-time management consultant, had lobbied his bosses at Viag to take Gerresheimer out of the beverage bottle business, where competition was intense and profit margins were low. To no avail. Viag had scant interest in Gerresheimer and even less appetite for the painful layoffs the entrepreneurial Herberg felt were necessary to convert Gerresheimer from a humdrum packaging business into a much sexier, healthcare-oriented packager. "We were part of a German conglomerate," Herberg says. Closing German factories, which he envisioned, would have been too much bad news for Viag. Under InvestCorp and Chase, Gerresheimer sold its beverages packaging factories and focused instead on specialized products where there was less competition and the customers were loyal. Plants in Germany and the United States were closed, and a new one with cheaper labor was opened in Mexico. But the process slowed when the economy turned down in 2002 and 2003, at a time when the company's owners had their own distractions. The InvestCorp partner, who had steered the deal, had left, and Chase had recently merged with J.P. Morgan. From their point of view, it was not the time to put more capital into the business, Herberg says, and they began looking for a buyer. Herberg met with Tony James and Doug Rogers, a Blackstone advisor on healthcare investments, in 2003. But it was another year after a drawn-out auction before Lionel Assand of Blackstone's London office finally inked the $705 million deal. The price was a modest 6.8 times Gerresheimer's cash flow. Because quality is crucial to drug makers, and packaging is a small component of the total cost of a drug, Gerresheimer's customers were unlikely to squeeze it on price. Herberg's goal was to carve out a niche by offering big drug makers a wide variety of containers, and to keep those customers so happy that they would not shop their business around. With Blackstone's backing, over the next 2 years, Herberg aggressively expanded Gerresheimer's range of pharmaceutical packaging by buying other businesses. Most of the acquisitions were small: a factory in New Jersey, 3 joint ventures in China, a Danish plant. But they added products such as pre-fillable syringes and specialized plastic containers. Negotiating privately, without going through auctions, Gerresheimer was able to snap up the assets at low multiples, just 4 to 7 times cash flow. It was the same tactic that conglomerates had used in the 1960s, and underlies many roll-up investments by private equity firms, namely, buy assets at low multiples and merge them into a bigger company that will be valued at a higher multiple. Unlike the conglomerates, Gerresheimer was realizing synergies because its purchases were all in the same industry. In one final dramatic stroke, in early 2007, Herberg arranged to buy the family-owned Wilden AG, which generated sales of more than $300 million a year, making inhalers and other products. Wilden's market was increasingly global, but the brothers who ran the business recognized that their company didn't have the wherewithal to compete effectively on a global scale, Herberg says. The deal boosted Gerresheimer's revenues by some 40% and broadened its product lines. That set the stage for Gerresheimer to go public, which it did in May 2007. In the less than 2 years since Blackstone had bought the company, revenue and cash flow were each up roughly 80%, and there were 71% more employees. Most of the increase stemmed from the acquisitions, but Gerresheimer had also boasted strong organic growth, with sales rising 13% and cash flow up 18%, excluding the new plants and businesses. The IPO, which raised more than $1.4 billion, was the biggest new issue in Germany so far that year. With the trend lines at Gerresheimer moving so firmly upward and stock prices rising globally, the company was valued at more than 10 times its 2007 cash flow, almost half again the 6.8 times ratio Blackstone had paid. Blackstone made back almost 5 times its money, selling shares in the IPO. When it sold the last of its shares in 2008, it came away with 7.5 times the $116 million it had invested. Having run the business as a subsidiary of a public conglomerate under 2 sets of private equity owners and as a standalone public company, Herberg believes the private equity stage was essential to the transition that created a bigger, more specialized, more profitable company. Gerresheimer couldn't have reached that point as a public company, he says. If you miss a quarter, you get beaten down immediately. You have more time under private equity, so you can take more risk. Contrary to the image of private equity backers as looking for a quick buck or euro, they actually create wiggle room for managers to execute difficult strategies, he says. You have long-term financing, 6 or 8 years. You have a lot of stability under private ownership, which is underestimated because all you see is the leverage. Once the business was more predictable, it made sense for the company to be public. We're on a different plateau. The value creation by transformation is done, he says, and the company will now grow organically. Its stock performed in line with other German industrial stocks in the year after the IPO. Merlin Entertainments Group Limited. With Merlin Entertainments, Blackstone did not so much buy a business and reshape it as concoct one from scratch. With a quick succession of acquisitions, it took a small domestic English aquarium operator and in 2 years made it into the second largest amusement park and visitor attraction operator in the world, after the Walt Disney Company. Blackstone's handiwork was the very antithesis of a cost-slashing, asset-stripping scheme. When Blackstone first eyed Merlin in 2005, it was a British company operating 22 Sea Life marine theme parks and the London Dungeon tourist attractions, all but a couple of which were in Britain. Like Gerresheimer, Merlin had an entrepreneurial CEO who had once been shackled by the management of its parent. Nick Varney had been running the business since the late 1990s, when it was owned by Varden PLC, whose core business was health and fitness clubs. He pressed to sell or close some of the smaller Sea Life parks and used the proceeds for capital expenditures on more promising attractions. But his bosses didn't want to forego the park's cash flow during the time it would take to develop new properties. In a public company, we were the Cinderella's sister in the nest, not getting the capital expenditures, not getting the attention, Varney recalls. The stock market was in love with health and fitness and out of love with visitor attractions. With financial backing from the big British buyout firm Apax Partners, Varney bought the business from Varden in 1999 and began building new Sea Life sites. The expansion continued when Apax sold the business to Hermes Private Equity, a smaller firm, in 2003. Merlin was still a minnow, with just $27 million of cash flow in 2004, and Varney had his sights set on something grander, the Legoland theme parks, which had been put up for sale by its parent, the Danish toy maker Lego. Hermes couldn't afford to finance the takeover of the much larger Legoland, but it was willing to sell Merlin if a buyer made an attractive offer. Enter Blackstone, in the person of Joseph Baratta, a young partner in the London office. Blackstone knew the amusement parks industry, having invested in the Six Flags and Universal Orlando theme parks. Across Europe there were mid-sized attractions, many owned by private equity firms, but no big operators. The properties were likely to come onto the market, since their owners would one day want to sell, and Baratta saw the chance to create an operator with heft. Schwartzman and James weren't sure Merlin was big enough to bother with. It was a tiny, bitty, little $50 million equity investment, Baratta explains. The equity check was probably less than they usually spend on deal fees, jokes Varney. But with the Legoland assets, there was the chance to create a more diversified and substantial business, and Baratta persuaded Blackstone's investment committee to give him the go-ahead. He began to negotiate simultaneously with both Merlin and the Christensen family that controlled Lego. And in back-to-back deals in mid-2005, Blackstone agreed to buy Merlin for about $200 million, and then got Legoland for about $450 million. Blackstone stumped up another $100 million in equity to fund the Legoland purchase, and the Christiansens took a 25% stake in the combined business in lieu of cash for part of the price, reducing Merlin and Blackstone's outlay. In management argo, Legoland was a transformative merger. It made Merlin a substantial player in continental Europe and added a mix of indoor Legoland discovery centers and outdoor Legoland parks with miniature Lego buildings, roads, and trains, giving Merlin a hedge against northern Europe's fickle weather. When the sun shone, we didn't do so well at the indoor sites, Varney explains. When it poured with rain, the outdoor attractions didn't do so well. He and Baratta thought Legoland could quickly be made more profitable. It was a strong brand, but its previous owners had seen it in part as a marketing tool for Lego toys and had not managed it aggressively. The parks attract a very well-heeled crowd, and they had underpriced the property, Baratta says. In other words, prices could be raised. Moreover, the management hadn't timed advertising to coincide with improvements at the parks, so the company wasn't reaping the full benefits when it made upgrades. Two more major acquisitions rounded out Merlin in 2006 and 2007. First, Blackstone invested another $140 million to fund the purchase of Gardaland, a water and theme park on Lake Garda at the base of the Italian Alps near Milan, which brought a sunny outdoor venue. The next year, Merlin merged with the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum chain, which gave it a new chain of internationally known indoor attractions. The former had been owned by an Italian private equity group, and the latter by an investment fund run by the government of Dubai. The Tussauds business, like Legoland, dwarfed Merlin in value, but Baratta hatched a financing scheme to make the deal affordable. Borrowing a page from two other buyouts he'd worked on in the United Kingdom, of the Spirit Pubs chain and the NHP Southern Cross nursing homes, he sold some of the enlarged group's valuable real estate to investors, who then leased it back to Merlin. The investors were willing to pay a rich price because they thought the properties would rise in value, and they were glad to lease them at advantageous rates in exchange for the potential appreciation. Selling the real estate at the top of the market, Merlin raised enough to pay the Dubai Fund $2 billion in cash. Like the Christiansen family, the Dubai Fund took a 20% stake in the merged business, rather than cashing out entirely. Merlin's biggest purchase by far was thus self-financed. Blackstone did not have to inject any new equity, retaining a 54% stake. With the Tussauds attractions, by 2008, Merlin had become